across Wisconsin from Civic Media. This is Up North News Radio. Now, live from our Lake Wissota studio, here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Breitlove.
Well, hey there, Wisconsin. Good morning. Welcome to the state of Wisconsin Sense from the shores of Lake Wissota, where it's a beautiful day up north. So beautiful, and it's going to be a great weekend. Going to be a little rain from time to time, but it's the first weekend of summer. Can't beat that. Thursday, June 22nd. Nice to have you here. It's 65 degrees here up on the lake. For folks listening on our home base, 93.5 The Tap. Fitchburg reporting 60 degrees this morning. Park Falls, 59. Sheboygan coming in at 58. Here's what's on tap this morning. Democratic strategist Joe Zepecki has a simple message for progressives unhappy with the school funding agreement between Governor Tony Evers and legislative Republicans. We'll share that coming up in less than a half hour. We will also have our hometown health segment in our next hour as America prepares to mark 1 year since the U.S. Supreme Court's repeal of Roe v. Wade. Democrats in Madison and Washington, D.C. are introducing bills to make clear the difference between the parties when it comes to respecting women's health care rights since the Dobbs decision relegated those rights to second-class status. Our segment features State Representative Lisa Subek and, of course, Dr. Kristen Lyerly, who will join us a little later this hour as well. Along the way, the phone lines are open at 844-967-2789, and our email address is radio at upnorthnewswi.com. And if you're watching this radio show as a live video feed on Facebook or the Up North News YouTube page or on Twitter, well, if on the Facebook page you leave a comment, we can see it and put that on screen and share it with you as well. Excuse me, I'm going to take a sip of coffee from my big old Liney's Lodge mug while we introduce Aaron Zommers down in Madison. Aaron, I needed the big Liney Lodge mug today. It's Thursday. Sometimes a little extra coffee is needed.
Yeah, those last couple of days in the week, it can take a bit. I should have brought some iced tea this morning. I'm feeling that too. But I have to say, that forecast, beautiful. 59 degrees, that's just where I want it.
Oh, I don't mean to gush so hard, but as I went through, you know, we go to bed early, so it's still pretty warm. So the last thing we do is we shut the air conditioner off because the house isn't going to heat up anymore. It's sunset, but the house is still sealed up, so it's comfortable. By the time you wake up a little after 4 a.m., if right then and there, if you then go around and open all the windows in the house when you wake up as an early riser, by about 5-6 o'clock in the morning, it is just so gorgeous out there. And I know I've gushed about it a lot lately, but honestly, is there anything better than this right now?
I would say there is.
You know, fall colors are nice. There's something nice about every season. But, you know, as I'm out there again today, driving around yesterday with my Jeep and running errands, you just think this is great. And all kinds of people are on the road today, or we're on the road. This is a huge weekend for folks. First weekend of summer, first day of Summerfest out in Milwaukee. We've talked about that, all the foods and things that'll be the foods, the acts, everything else. Then passing by me here in Chippewa Falls is basically a parade of RVs on their way out toward Cadott for Country Fest, which is this weekend. And that'll include Dan and Shay, Zach Brown Band, Sammy Kershaw, Pam Tillis, and more. But I think perhaps most importantly for this weekend, Aaron, of all the things that are happening, the World Naked Bike Ride will be in Milwaukee this Saturday.
Is that so?
Don't say like you didn't know. Don't say like you weren't already.
I did not. I knew about the one in Madison. I didn't know. I don't know where else it is.
Apparently, it's the World Naked Bike Ride, and it does take part in. Let's see. It says here, 20 countries and 70 different cities each year. The ride this Saturday starts at Kuchansky's Bar on South 37th in Milwaukee. And there's a Google map that outlines the route that will take people around and loop through the Third Ward and then back to the bar. It's clothing optional, which means they say you can wear as little or as much as you like, because the bike ride is all about promoting body positivity, cyclist awareness, and energy independence. So wherever you fit in that thing, are you happy about bike riding? You happy about body image? You want to talk about energy independence? Take your clothes off. Come down to Milwaukee and ride a bike for a little while.
Yeah, you know, more power to you. I hope you accomplish your mission with minimal chafing.
Yeah, exactly. The ride will start at 4 o'clock sharp. They'll have music, vendors, yoga, food trucks, and of course, body painting. And for those folks who wonder, how are they getting away with this? Well, they're not really getting away with anything because it's a protest. It's a First Amendment protest. And so as long as participants don't engage in anything, lewd and lascivious, it's legal, according to what the organizers told the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Local police treat the bike ride as a protest. And so alcohol and inappropriate behavior are not allowed. So I don't know that that's the kind of thing we necessarily think about at 6 o'clock in the morning, but for folks who don't know if they want to go to Summerfest or if they want to go to Country Fest or go someplace else, we've just performed the public service of giving them a new option, Aaron. That's all this is.
Yes, that's all it is. And if you don't want to go, oh, well, you're more informed.
There will still be spectators, nevertheless, shall we say. And that cuts both ways. I recall seeing somebody talked about being trapped in an intersection as the one went through Madison and said, I've seen things my eyes can never unsee. But again, it's about that body positivity. We come in all flavors, and we're all the better for it. When we come back, we'll find out how the Brewers wrapped up their series with the Arizona Diamondbacks at home before they hit the road for a long road trip. That and some headlines coming up next. You're up north.
Okay. What do you mean? Wait a minute. Give me a break a second.
This is Todd Rundgren.
One, two, three.
Todd Rundgren was born 75 years ago today outside of Philadelphia, a member of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame fairly recently, who, of course, gave us that Bang the Drum All Day song you hear after every Packer touchdown and so much more. And that, of course, included Hello, It's Me, is a hit from back in the day as well. So more music and historical notes coming up at 6:50. Dr. Kristen Lyerly will join us at that point as well. Studio line is open at 844-967-2789. In sports at 6:16, once again, the Milwaukee Brewers have had some decent starting pitching, but the relievers gave up hits and the hitters gave us no relief. What had been a pitcher's duel for the first five innings ended in a 5-1 romp by the Arizona Diamondbacks yesterday afternoon, making the Brewers losers of 8 of 9 games, I believe. I'm going to double check that. It might be 8 of 10. Pitcher Julio Teheran went scoreless for the Brewers over five innings and gave up only 2 hits, but he also allowed 4 walks. Raimel Tapia, who signed with the Brewers last week after being released by Boston, broke a scoreless tie. Tapia's 10 for 18 in his career against Arizona's starting pitcher. That homer was Tapia's first hit with the Brewers after an 0 for 10 start. Now, the Brewers are a game and a half back of Cincinnati in the National League Central. I wouldn't get too worked up about that because the Reds are riding a 10-game winning streak right now, and gravity will bring them back to earth before too much longer. The Brewers are off today. They head to Cleveland for the weekend. Then the road trip takes them out to play the New York Mets and then the Pittsburgh Pirates. And you can catch those Brewers games in the Fox Valley on Oshkosh Air Support 98.3, 1100 AM, and news from the Center and Richland Center 107.7 and 1450 AM. All right, now to a few headlines. You can react to them. You can vent a little about them. You can share what else is on your mind at 844-967-2789. You can tell me your plans for the World Naked Bike Ride or Summerfest or wherever else you happen to be traveling this weekend. And again, you can comment on our live video feed on Facebook. But I wanted to revisit a point that I started to make yesterday about two right-wing justices on two Supreme Courts. You have Samuel Alito, who I believe is the leaker of last year's Dobbs decision preview, and Rebecca Bradley, both of whom I quite accurately describe as politicians in justices' robes. And specifically, I want to underscore that point in this way. What has been the calling card of right-wing politics? Blame the media. The liberal media, which was never liberal in the first place. Just ask any liberal. But by concocting a narrative that the people who report on them have some kind of an agenda, they inoculate themselves against any criticism, no matter how true it is. It worked for Rush Limbaugh and Newt Gingrich and then Fox News and the whole right-wing media bubble that followed. Everyone else reporting about us is wrong. Clearly they hate us, so trust us, not the people uncovering what it is we're actually doing. To no surprise, that mentality has spread to right-wing politicians in justices' robes. For example, with Justice Samuel Alito, who knew that the newsroom ProPublica was working on a report about the justice accepting a free luxury vacation that included a billionaire who later argued a case before the court, one from which Alito did not recuse himself. Rather than answer the questions that were put up by ProPublica, Alito wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal trying to scoop the report. And the Wall Street Journal allowed him to do that, which again just says something about right-wing media. And let's see how much the Wall Street Journal's reporting is respected, you know, the next time some other news outlet catches wind of it. But set that aside for a moment. Just come back to the whole nature of Alito not nearly addressing what he did, the unethical conduct, so much as blaming the media and saying that, you know, they've got it in for him. And all you got to do is Google up Samuel Alito and the media. And over the years, you get a host of headlines about Alito blasts media, Alito mocks critics, rage-filled Alito baffled that his fairness is questioned, Alito attacks Biden, Alito slams ProPublica as misleading, and on it goes. Because again, it's that whole blame the media mentality rather than just decide the case before you. Let your agreements or your dissents speak for you. We're not saying justices have to be perfect, and we're certainly not saying that justices can't have a bias. But it seems that there are some justices that are engaging in increasingly blatant political behavior. And that takes us back to the other case that I was mentioning yesterday that first came up in an article by Jesse O'Point in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And for those that missed it yesterday, it's a case that started in 2020. A group of parents sued the school district in Madison over a policy that allows students to self-identify their names and pronouns without involving the parents. And the policy bars staff from sharing information related to a student's gender identity without the student's authorization. And there's a reason for that. In so many of these cases with children, with youth who are having questions about gender and sexuality, they don't always have the most supportive parents. Some are hostile. Some are abusive. And school is about their only safe haven. But on the state Supreme Court, a couple of the right-wing justices wanted to fast-track that case, basically steal it away from the Court of Appeals and take it up yourself. That's the kind of thing you do before strapping someone into the electric chair. It's hardly a matter for a case about pronouns where you need to rush it up to the state Supreme Court. But Rebecca Bradley was demanding that immediate opportunity to be a culture warrior. She was upset that fellow conservative Brian Hagedorn refused to go along with fast-tracking the case. Hagedorn said it had nothing to do with values, but it was about the plaintiff just did not have standing to actually bring the lawsuit in this particular case. Now, so let's pick up the story from there. Rebecca Bradley waited for about 3 weeks after the original decision, according to the story, and then filed an amended dissent so that she could take shots at Hagedorn, and Hagedorn responded that Bradley had abandoned some basic judicial decorum. And here's what Hagedorn wrote. It's no wonder our Supreme Court races are seen as high-stakes affairs when this court is seen as willing, even eager, to dispense with standard procedures and forcefully insert itself into the latest hot-button political issues. This case presents a prime example, Hagedorn wrote, that when the court gets caught up in the fervors of the moment, we make mistakes. End quote. Bradley's dissent reads more like someone auditioning for Fox News than a serious arbiter of the law, as she blamed, quote, a biased media, a biased media propounded by political partisans bent on tearing down the judiciary as an institution whenever a court reaches outcomes disfavored by the progressive political movement, end quote. Serious question here. What does Rebecca Bradley care about progressive political movements? Are you deciding the merit of the case, including standing to bring such a case? Or are you jockeying for the next vacancy on right-wing radio? Jesse O'Poyne noted that, you know, this judicial sparring is far different, a far different tone than when Hagedorn first ran for the state Supreme Court 4 years ago. Back then, Bradley said to the Journal Sentinel, quote, he's the best of men. He's a very kind person. He's a very giving person, very selfless, always looking to where he can be helpful. And I only bring that up because it's awfully reminiscent of the before and after quotes that we ran the other day about Donald Trump and his cabinet picks. It's always easy to talk up somebody when you think they're always going to be on your side. And then when it turns out they're only most of the time on your side, they're terrible people. And it's not just Justice Bradley. Conservative Justice Annette Ziegler goes down the same road, writing a dissent that said the decision not to fast-track this particular case, quote, fails the parents of Wisconsin and abdicates its responsibility to decide some of the most important issues of our time. Wait a minute. Some of the most important issues of our time? Pronouns? Where have we heard that before? Oh, yeah. This past weekend, when Robin Voss talked about the University of Wisconsin's work to confront racism, he said at the state Republican convention, quote, this is probably, to me, the single most important issue that we are facing as a people, as a nation, and as really humanity, end quote. Humanity. These culture warriors are attacking education and making a mockery of our state Supreme Court in order to fight political battles against racial fairness and personal respect. They need to focus far less on what the media says about them and more about deciding cases based on the rule of law. And in the case of Alito and Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia before him, abiding by a certain code of ethics that every other judge, every other federal employee has to follow. You're not special because you're a U.S. Supreme Court justice. Fact of the matter is, you are special in the sense that if anybody should be acting in the highest ethical manner, it's you. And when you're caught, essentially, catching a free ride on some billionaire's jet to go on a fishing expedition to some lodge, nobody's saying you can't do it, but you could report it and you could recuse yourself when that same billionaire has cases that come before the court. But conservatives have had an issue with that level of transparency and accountability, because back at the state Supreme Court level a few years back, there was wide agreement among the conservative justices to loosen up the rules so that they did not have to recuse themselves from some cases that involved donors to their campaigns. And they knew that these campaigns were getting big and expensive. As Justice Hagedorn said, it's no wonder our Supreme Court races are seen as high-stakes affairs when this court is seen as willing, even eager, to dispense with standard procedures and forcefully insert itself into the latest hot-button political issues. Hagedorn, for being as conservative as he is, and he still is at least cognizant of what his actual job is and the ethics that come with it. And as should be the case so often in politics, we're not going to agree on everything all the time. Hagedorn has made decisions with which I strongly disagree. But at least he's doing the job through the prism of what he considers to be ethical service. And for that, compared to some of his colleagues in Madison and Washington, D.C., he should be saluted. We will have Joe Zepecki coming up next after this break. You're up north. Now on this Thursday morning, Joseph Pecky joins us. As always, Joe, good morning.
Top of the morning to you.
Yeah, we have had a busy week. The state budget is getting into its late stages. There was kind of that diversion with the big compromise over revenue sharing and school funding. But now back to the heart of the budget. The Joint Finance Committee is going to meet at 4:30 this afternoon with two big things yet to take care of. The UW system and a tax cut, because we always knew if the Republicans were going to do one thing, it was going to be a tax cut. But let's start with a little guessing game about the UW system. Robin Voss,
well, can I start a guessing game of my own?
Yes, please do.
You've been in the legislature, and yes. I know you're a baseball fan.
Yes.
Are we in the ninth inning yet, or what do we call this? Is this the seventh inning stretch? Are we in the eighth?
Top of the eighth. Top of the eighth, and then when it's all done in joint finance, that will be the end of the eighth inning, and then I don't know who gets it first, the Assembly or the Senate, but you know whatever house
that'll
gets
be
that.
The top of the ninth,
and then the bottom of the ninth, the other house, and then we have to go into extra innings if for some reason they can't agree, and there may be reasons why that we're going to get into in just a minute here, but before we get past the eighth inning. On the UW system, even at a time of a surplus, Assembly Speaker Robin Voss wants a cut just because he can. Do you think cooler heads are going to prevail? It sure doesn't sound like Senate Republicans are eager to go along with that.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I mean, there's just no excuse for this. We have been deferring costs and deferring investments in higher education for almost a generation at this point, right? I mean,
right.
When you have a $7 billion surplus, you have the opportunity to make smart strategic investments that over the long haul are going to reap dividends for the state. Now is the time to do things like build this new engineering building at a time when our state needs engineers and when the engineers that are graduating are getting jobs. We need that new building to attract the best and the brightest. We need to stop with this malarkey of Robin Voss crying about diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those are important principles in higher education, in the workforce, in the world as it is. And, you know, as opposed to trying to make this the next, you know, boycott of a business for being too woke, which is what I think this ultimately is Speaker Voss just trying to score some points. Let's do the right thing. Let's choose this moment to invest in higher education that has long-term dividends for the state of Wisconsin.
Let's stick with higher education for a minute, because yesterday the Assembly met and there was this thought that they might take up this bill on the Wisconsin Technical College system that was, I don't know what else to call it other than a sneak attack, taking an old bill, stripping out the old language, pasting in new language, passing it out of committee without any kind of a public hearing, this major overhaul of how you would pay for the tech colleges. And Joe, did they really think that was going to pass all the way through? It's such a big change and such a sneaky way to do it. What does it take to get them to treat any form of education with the respect it deserves?
So listen, it's long been said that when you're arguing process in politics, you are losing.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of understand where that's coming from. But I actually think nowadays, people understand that with moves like this, which are intentional choices by Robin Voss and by Republicans, they are trying to abuse a system to their benefit because they know that there would not be popular public support for this. We know that on issue after issue, this Republican Party has no problem opposing the will of the people, whether that's on cannabis, whether for medical or recreational, whether that's on a minimum wage, whether that's on Medicaid expansion. They have no problem disagreeing with the majority of Wisconsinites. And they are smart enough at controlling the levers of power to know that on a fight like this, they're going to be on the wrong side of the people. And so if they want to do it, their best hope for getting it through is to try and do it quickly in a way that nobody notices. And that's what they tried to do. Thank goodness they didn't get away with it, because now there's going to be an outcry. You are exactly right. You cannot make this big a change to one of the most important parts of the education infrastructure. You know, technical colleges are, many would argue, even more closely entwined with our workforce and meeting those challenges than our university system. And to try to wholesale change the way that those colleges are funded does not make sense. It needs to be an open, honest public debate. Republicans know that what they want to do isn't going to sell with the public. So they tried to sneak it through and they got caught. And honestly, what is that? It's just another time where that happened to them.
Yes. And I should say that in terms of arguing process, this particular radio program will be the one that does that, because it's hosted by, you know, a political junkie, a nerd. If I were just writing up the news story about it, I'd skip a lot of that and just say, you know, Republicans are trying to change how to pay for tech colleges without asking for any public input. And people would get that. But, you know, if you're going to listen to this program, you're coming along for the ride. You get to see all the nuts and bolts and the corridors of the Capitol. And that can sometimes be a scary place to be. But the better you understand it, the better you think, I don't know, do I want that person representing me? We'll see.
The more you know.
Imagine the rainbow. There it is. The more you know, kids, right over your radio. OK, now let's get to tax cuts, which seems to be the main point of anything the Republicans are doing this year, because they're, like you mentioned, they said no to the College of Engineering. They're trying to change tech colleges. They're, you know, siphoning money away, you know, with voucher schools. They've cut in the middle of the night, you know, this child care program to take care of the worker shortage. So apparently they were waiting all this time to see how much of the surplus they could put to a tax cut and say, that's it, boys. Our work here is done. Yes?
Well, Pat, you sound surprised. You can't be surprised.
I'm not surprised at all. I've been saying for almost a year this is a heist in the making of what they want to do with the surplus.
Yeah, and listen, I'm not going to sit here and tell anybody that if you have a $7 billion surplus, that some of it shouldn't go back to tax relief.
Oh, no, absolutely should. Yes,
yeah, you're not going to do that either.
Right.
You know, Republicans in the last, I would say 20 years, like really in the 21st century, have somehow become a party that believes that the answer to every challenge is a tax cut for those at the top. I wish I was kidding. I wish I was over exaggerating, mm-hmm. But this is where they are as a party. It doesn't matter that when they do the big tax cuts, like the 2017 Trump tax cuts, again, towards those at the top, that it doesn't work, that it explodes the deficit, that it increases the national debt, that the economy still can't sustain, you know, the ebbs and flows. Their answer to everything is a tax cut. And that's okay, right? At least we know who they are. And
where's my Denny Green soundbite? They are who we thought they were.
And in a strange way, I sort of admire their restraint in ending with the tax cut, as opposed to starting with it, because it would have been really easy for them to say, we're going to do a $6.5 billion tax cut, permanent, right? Mm-hmm. And we're going to leave $500 million to fight over in the budget.
Yeah.
Instead, they have gone through most of the budget, and there have been some real Democratic wins, including more money for K-12 public schools than in a very long time. And now that they know how much of that surplus they have invested in things like that, now they're saying, okay, we know how much we have left to do a tax cut. My fear, of course, is that tax cut is going to go to those at the very top, big business, those who, you know, are able to pay a smaller percentage of their taxes than firefighters and teachers, and that not enough of it is going to go to those who would really benefit from it. But we're just going to have to wait and see. And, is this damning with faint praise to give them a little bit of credit for holding it till the end? I don't know, but I'm trying to be fair and acknowledge that this was always what was going to happen. And frankly, as somebody who has cut taxes throughout his term, it was always something that Tony Evers wanted to be a part of this package too. And we should allow for that.
Oh, by the way, speaking of a budget that could go into extra innings, and forgive me if I'm wrong, but I don't think we ultimately answered this question. Will Robin Voss get a cut for the UW system, or will there ultimately be an increase because we have such a surplus?
They have to keep it at what it was. They can't cut it. They just can't.
Okay. Now, to the child care counts, middle of the night, you know, slashing $340 million proposed by Governor Evers down to zero. We know that that has child care providers and parents and small business people doing whatever they can. And we see this every couple of years, maybe not every budget cycle, but we see something come up where there is that discussion of, is this that thing that is going to be the rare instance of a reversal when it gets to the floor of the Assembly and Senate? Are there enough Republicans in the rank and file that are going to say, you know, this doesn't look right. There's a child care crisis out there. We've got to do something. We can't cut it down to zero. Or do they stick with the talking point of, you know, child care is like any other business. Suck it up, Buttercup.
Yeah, I don't know if there's enough Republican legislators who understand that, but I do know that there are enough constituents of Republican legislators to let them know in the next week or so, and that can make all the difference. That people need to understand, and those who have kids of a certain age who rely on childcare, they know it all too well, how hard it has been to find quality childcare, how hard it is to afford quality childcare, what that conversation is like after you get those kids to bed and mom and dad are sitting down at the kitchen table and trying to figure out, does it make sense for both of us to work? Boy, almost all of one of our salaries is getting eaten up by childcare costs. And so that reality for Wisconsin parents and families does not know partisanship. It is not a Democratic problem. It is not a Republican problem. It's not an independent problem. It's not an urban problem versus a suburban problem. It's a problem everywhere. And so if you are one of those parents who could be impacted by even more scarcity when it comes to the availability of childcare, I would urge you to call your legislator this week and let them know, hey, this matters. This is going to have an impact on my life. And this ultimately impacts the broader Wisconsin economy. If we have more parents unable to join the workforce, that's not good for businesses. That's not good for the state as a whole. I certainly hope, and I think there is room for a reversal on this by Republicans, but they're going to have to hear from moms and dads all across Wisconsin.
Final question comes back to that grand deal that was reached between Governor Evers and legislative Republicans. It improved revenue sharing to local governments. It gave more money to public schools. It gave more money to voucher schools. We're done talking about the nuts and bolts of the deal. My question to you is, looking forward, how should Democrats be messaging this in the near term? And is it, in fact, some kind of an issue that they run on in 2024? Or will this be long forgotten by then?
For a generation, Republicans underfunded our schools and starved our local units of government of resources. That impacted the quality of life in the state of Wisconsin, everything from the roads we drive on to our ability to trust the water we drink coming out of the faucet. It took Tony Evers as governor and Democrats fighting Republicans at every turn to invest more in K-12 public schools than we have in a generation, and to finally do right by the local units of government that are closest to the people of Wisconsin. If you believe in good public schools, if you believe in local government that can do its basic duties, then you're a Democrat. You want to vote for Democrats in the future. Because if it wasn't for Democrats like Tony Evers, this wouldn't have gotten done. That's how I'd be talking about it every single day between now and 2024.
I think that answer ran about 55 seconds. Slap a 5-second tag on it. This paid for by. And just run that on a loop next year, boys and girls. I can't be any more clear than that. Joseph Pecky, as always, thank you so much. Have a great weekend.
Talk to you next week.
Words of wisdom from Mr. Zepecki. Take the win, because imagine what Wisconsin would be like. Imagine what this legislative session would be like if Tim Michaels were in the governor's office instead. Dr. Kristen Lyerly is part of our Hometown Health with State Representative Lisa Subek in our next hour on new legislation designed to protect the right to contraceptives in Wisconsin. But she joins us to talk about, you know, a little history lesson and some music history as well coming up next. You're up north. All right, everybody's favorite fun girl from Civic Media, Dr. Kristen Lyerly, joins us now from Green Bay. And it's Cyndi Lauper's birthday, Kristen. Want to take a guess on what birthday she's celebrating?
Oh, I'm going to go 65.
70.
Whoa.
Cyndi Lauper is 70 years old today and still telling you that girls just want to have fun.
Because it's true.
Yes. And it's a wonderful anthem, and that's why it has staying power to this day. There are a few other, I would call them surprising birthdays, but you folks at home can be the judge of that. It is Kris Kristofferson's birthday. He was born in Brownsville, Texas. Want to take a guess on Kris Kristofferson?
Oh, yeah. He's got to be 88.
87. Very good. Yeah. California Senator Dianne Feinstein turns 90 today. A trailblazing woman in politics of decades back, and perhaps we'll leave it at that in terms of her current U.S. Senate career. And then this is interesting in terms of the baby boom. All of these babies were born this day in 1949. All of these folks turned 74 today. Meryl Streep, Senator Elizabeth Warren, Alan Osman of the Osman Brothers, and Lindsay Wagner, the bionic woman, with which you have a passing resemblance. And I sometimes wonder, given your constant level of energy, if maybe you aren't partially bionic in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, I have a... I have some of that.
called caffeine. Yeah, whatever it takes.
Oh, I love that show back in the day. And I love that you threw Alan Osmond into the...
you want to hear scary? Hear scary. Alan, it's Alan, Jay, Merrill, and oh shoot! Now it just left me, but I could always name. It's still in there. All the names of the Osmond brothers, because you watched. There was Donnie and Merle. Well, Donnie was like the additional. The Osmonds were initially, Alan, Wayne, Jay, Merrill, and then Donnie, and then Marie came along, and I don't know why that's stuck in there. I can't control alt delete that thing. We already mentioned Todd Rundgren is 75 today, and we know what song he's most famous for around here. Now, Kristen, I know you don't actually live anywhere near Lambeau, but doesn't it sometimes feel like you can hear that song coming from across the way whenever the Packers score a touchdown?
I can see Lambeau when I look out my kitchen window.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Very
nice. Just makes me feel like every time I hear that song, like I'm drinking out of my Packer mug this morning.
Oh, very nice.
I was talking with some friends of mine about scheduling some things in the fall yesterday, and there was a Packer game that was a conflict. And, you know, it just made me feel so excited. Like there's so much enthusiasm for this upcoming season.
There is. And, you know, I'll say again, it's not that we're not thankful to Aaron Rodgers for past, you know, good deeds, but you just kind of feel like the fresh start is here now.
Are you feeling the love?
I'm feeling the love. Yes. On this day in 1955, Lady and the Tramp opened in theaters. No couple has ever eaten spaghetti the same ever since. And then here's a couple of women in music. And these are not the kinds of things you'd normally say, oh, you know, we associate with that day. But they're kind of noteworthy. On this day in 1964, Dolly Parton moved to Nashville, which is only noteworthy because it was one day after she graduated from high school. She left her small town, she packed up, headed to Nashville, and, you know, nothing's been the same since in that city for 59 years. Mm-hmm. And on this day, 10 years later, in 1974, a 15-year-old Madonna goes to her first concert, David Bowie, in Detroit. And she says, I recognized myself in him somehow, and he gave me license to dream a different future for myself.
Wow.
Again, coming back to the, you don't know the influence you have on people that you will never, ever meet. 1963 on this day, the Safaris released this long-running classic hit.
Wipeout.
Which I'm going to probably guess has been the bane of every teacher ever since, as kids try to bang that out on their hands, on their desk with their hands.
Mm-hmm. Did you see Aaron get going there? For those of you who can't see the video feed, Aaron immediately just popped right into it.
He was all set. On this day in 1969, the Cuyahoga River caught fire in Cleveland, drawing national attention to water pollution. It spurred passage of the Clean Water Act and creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. And to every right winger that wants to get rid of all that stuff and says, we don't need that government regulation, I will remind you the Cuyahoga River caught fire on this day in 1969. This was rather groundbreaking at the time. On this day in 1990, Billy Joel became the first rock act to play Yankee Stadium. We all know the Beatles had done Shea Stadium, but no rock act to play at Yankee Stadium until Billy Joel this day in 1990.
Perfect.
On this day in 1991, NWA's second and final studio album featuring a title we cannot say on the radio hit number one on this day, becoming the fourth rap album to hit number one after the Beastie Boys, MC Hammer, and Vanilla Ice paved the way over the previous year. On this day in 1993, the Flaming Lips released their sixth studio album, Transmissions from the Satellite Heart. And in 1999, Limp Bizkit debuted at number one with their second studio album, Significant Other. Kristen, you were one busy person again, this time around heading down to the state capitol because of the one-year anniversary of the Dobbs decision. Give us a little preview of what we're going to be talking about in Hometown Health.
Well, that was a little bit of what we did yesterday, but mostly what we did was introduce a bill to protect our right to receive and prescribe contraception. Representative Lisa Subak, Dora Drake, and Senator Dianne Hesselbein put together this really necessary piece of legislation that mirrors what our federal Congress put together earlier in the week. And man, it's so hard to believe that we need legislation to protect our ability to get contraception, but we do.
Oh, that's exactly the world that we live in these days. So look for more of that coming up in our next hour. But in our final time here, a note about whether this is your dream, Kristen and Aaron, because it was the dream of a Milwaukee teacher to make it onto The Price is Right. And she did with an episode that aired this week, said she's dreamed of being on there. I want to get her name right. Oh, Mary Seawald. Said she's dreamt of being on television's longest running game show since she was a little girl. And she didn't make it all the way to the showcase, but she did win, what was it? A trip to Asia, I believe it was. Yeah, a week-long trip to Asia, a camera, and lawn furniture. Kristen, how would you have done on The Price is Right?
You know, I have been watching that show since I was a little girl with Bob Barker. I don't watch it now, mm-hmm. currently, but it's just such a part of my past. Those games are, I don't know, Pat.
I don't know the price of Rice-A-Roni. I know. Aaron, how about you? Ever thought about being on The Price is Right?
Let me tell you how I would do.
Okay. See, if The Price is Right did nothing else, it gave us pop culture moments like the sad trombones and the dings and, you know, the showcase showdown and
the
yodeling. That's my favorite one. The little mountain climber. I would have loved that game. All right. We'll take a break here. But first, we'll come back with Aaron and Kristen because it's a special day on the National Day calendar. Get your hashtags and your movie memories ready. Coming up after this, you're up north.